I'm going to assume quite a bit tonight because the subject has been advertised. I take it that you have been doing a lot of reading on your own, and I shall confine myself to reading some verses from the 12th of Exodus, and if we may turn to that chapter now, and we'll read from verse 1 through to verse 8. And the Lord spake unto Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, This month shall be unto you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. Speak ye unto all the congregation of Israel, saying, In the 10th day of this month they shall take to them every man a lamb, according to the house of their fathers, a lamb for an house. And if the household be too little for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next unto his house take it according to the number of the souls. Every man according to his eating shall make your count for the lamb. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. Ye shall take it out from the sheep or from the goats, and ye shall keep it up until the 14th day of the same month, and the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it in the evening. And they shall take of the blood and strike it on the two side posts and on the upper doorpost of the houses, wherein they shall eat it. And they shall eat the flesh in that night, roast with fire, and unleavened bread, and with bitter herbs they shall eat it. Now, could we turn over, please, to the book of Leviticus and to chapter 23 of the book of Leviticus. And we shall be reading concerning the feasts of Jehovah, but confining our reading to the two feasts that we have to deal with tonight. So we'll read from verse 4. These are the feasts of the Lord, even holy convocations, which ye shall proclaim in their seasons. In the 14th day of the first month at even is the Lord's Passover. And on the 15th day of the same month is the feast of unleavened bread unto the Lord. 7 days ye must eat unleavened bread. In the first day ye shall have an holy convocation. Ye shall do no servile work therein, but ye shall offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord 7 days. In the seventh day is an holy convocation. Ye shall do no servile work therein. Now the following verses of this chapter of Leviticus indicates to us that there was another feast associated with the feast of Passover and unleavened bread, but since it is out with our study tonight, we are not going to look at it in particular, and I refer to the feast of first fruits, which took place 2 days after the Passover feast was celebrated. Now I'd like you to turn to the New Testament, and we're going to read, first of all, in the book of Corinthians, and in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, the 1 Corinthians chapter 5. The church at Corinth had a very embarrassing situation to deal with. And dealing with it, they got advice from the apostle. And in the middle of that advice, we're going to read from verse 7. Purge out, therefore, the old leaven, that ye may be a new lump, as ye are unleavened. For even Christ, our Passover, is sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, neither with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. And another writer of our New Testament has some things to say about the Feast of Passover. He doesn't use the expression Passover, but he certainly refers to the redemption that was involved within the work of the Passover, and I am referring to Peter, and in his first epistle, and in his first exhortation, which begins with verse 13 of chapter 1, he writes like this: "Wherefore, gird up the loins of your mind, be sober, and hope to the end for the grace that is to be brought unto you at the revelation of Jesus Christ, as obedient children, not fashioning yourselves according to the former lusts in your ignorance, but as he which hath called you is holy, so be ye holy in all manner of conversation, because it is written, Be ye holy, for I am holy. And if you call on the Father, who without respect of persons judgeth according to every man's work, pass the time of your sojourning here in fear, for, as much as ye know that ye were not redeemed with corruptible things as silver and gold, from your vain conversation received by tradition from your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb without blemish and without spot, who verily was foreordained before the foundation of the world, but was manifest in these last times for you, who by him do believe in God, that raised him up from the dead and gave him glory, that your faith and hope might be in God." I want to look at these two feasts in a very simple way this evening, and trust that the Lord will bless us in our consideration of them. I want first to look with you at the primary meaning of the feasts, and then to look at the prophetic import of the feasts, and finally to look at the practical implications for us today. The primary meaning of the feast would take us back much farther than Exodus chapter 12, and would in fact take us away back more than 400 years before what happened, as is reported in Exodus 12. It would take us back to the time when God made a promise, and when in that promise he prophesied, and the prophecy was such that for over 400 years, the people who were the descendants of Abraham who received the promise would sojourn in a strange land, and then they would be delivered, and then they would be redeemed. They would be brought out of that bondage, and they would be brought out by the Lord. Abraham was not given the way in which the deliverance would take place. He simply received the promise, and he heard the prophecy. Unlike all those promises that God gives, he doesn't tell us everything in the promise. He simply makes the promise, and he challenges our faith to accept that he will substantiate the promise. So that all that happened from the time when Jacob and his family went down to Egypt, and over those many years when a Pharaoh after Pharaoh would arise, who would be unsympathetic to the descendants of Abraham, they would come to the point in time when God would fulfill his promise. Now, I think that is very cheering to us in this 20th century. Promises have been made to us, and we know not when they're going to be fulfilled, nor perhaps do we know every way in which they will be fulfilled. But just as history records the fulfillment of the early promise to Abraham, so God will fulfill every promise he has made. The deliverance then was the subject of prophecy. It also, for the primary meaning, one must remember that there would be a tremendous challenge to the nation of Israel itself, and to their leader in particular, their leader being Moses. He had at least 9 times sought the deliverance of the nation. Exodus chapter 2 would indicate to us that there was knowledge of the promise that was made to Abraham, that they knew about the prophecy of their deliverance, of how they would be lifted out and transferred to a new land. They knew about that. And for 9 different occasions, their hopes had been lifted and then dashed again. And now comes the 10th. And the Lord speaks unto Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt. And this is what we began to read with tonight, the opening words of chapter 12. And the challenge was to their faith, first of all, that what God had promised, he would do. Little did they realize that in the purposes of God, he would set up a way of deliverance that would become an annual memorial to the nation, and would become the very groundwork upon which every relationship he had with his people would be based. And so when we enter chapter 12 of the book of Exodus, we are looking into one of the most eventful and epoch-making chapters in the whole of our Bible. We now reach the point in history when God is not dealing with families any longer. He is now dealing with nations. And in the ongoing events of history, we reached the point where God was going to constitute a new nation, a nation that to him would become a peculiar people, that would become a very special treasure, that would be very, very precious to him. So the events of the chapter become very important to us, and they assume a new significance. So much so that the chapter indicates that this month would be to them the beginning of months. Hitherto the month Tisri, which was in the autumn of the year, was the first month that would be observed as the first of the year. But now God was changing this, and he was now giving to this nation a new calendar. He was about to give to the nation a new government. He was about to give to the nation a new constitution. He was about to introduce to the nation the divine religion. And he had to solidly base it on something that would stand, something that would be fundamentally sound, something whose foundations would remain. And so we have in the chapter the story of redemption, the story of how God redeemed his people. It's a moving story. and against the background of an Egypt who were tyrants and masters of the nation, who had their own gods with their own special emblems and symbols. And every Egyptian god had an animal as their symbol. But in most cases, each of those animals that they chose were of fierce or of fighting qualities. The lion, the tiger, the bull. Those all belonged to the gods of Egypt. But the God of Israel is going to do something quite different. And he said to Moses and to Aaron, and all the challenge to their faith, select a lamb. I want you to try and stand in the shoes of Moses and Aaron as they listen to the divine voice giving them such a command. Take a lamb. Albeit the family unit was the unit known in the nation of Israel, in what would become later the nation of Israel. So it was incumbent upon Moses and Aaron, and in the divine economy, that there would be a lamb for a house, or a lamb for a family. And one can see in verse 3, for example, the idea of the selection of the lamb. It has been often pointed out the difference in the descriptions between verses 3, 4, and 5. A lamb, verse 3. The lamb, verse 4. Your lamb, verse 5. And one can see the progression of thought that there is in the voice that came from heaven. First of all, they had to select a lamb. And they might have been saying, and what do we do with a lamb? What sort of emblem is this to take a nation of slaves out of their bondage? What we need is something with certainly not a lamb. And then God says, and the lamb will be sufficient. It would not only be sufficient, as verse 4 tells us, for the house, but for the household. It wouldn't only be sufficient for the household, but it would be sufficient for their redemption and for their deliverance. I don't know if you have noticed that in that lovely chapter of Hebrews, where we read of the personal faith of individuals, and you come to the man Moses, you will find against his name is recorded this: by faith he kept the Passover. I've often wondered at the import of that until I've reread Exodus 12. And it would seem to me that the man whose faith was being challenged was the faith of the mediator, was the faith of the leader, was it the faith of Moses? And to his credit, by faith, he kept the Passover. And so when you read down the chapter, you will find that the weight of responsibility ultimately rests with Moses, shared somewhat by the elders and the fathers of every house. But ultimately, it was Moses' responsibility. I want you to notice that in the primary meaning of this feast of Passover, that the lamb had to be without blemish. Not only had it to be selected, not only would it prove to be sufficient, but now verse 5 is telling us of its character, of its nature, of its worth, of its preciousness. It had to be spotless. You will note in verse 6 that it had to be scrutinized. It had to be kept from the 10th to the 14th day of the same month. I want you to think now for a minute. When the feast of Passover was first celebrated here on this occasion, there is the idea of haste in the eating. They had to eat it with one hand on a staff, on the other hand taking a piece of the lamb that was roast with fire, or a cake of unleavened bread, and they to eat in haste. They had not to recline at the table as was their wont. They had not to lie on couches as once was their wont, but now, in haste. But, against that now think, if there had to be so much haste involved, and if the problem of urgency was real, why is God allowing a lamb to be kept for four precious days, from the 10th to the 14th day? I'm going to submit to you that the spotlessness of Christ is worth taking time to look at. The impeccable purity of Christ is being foreshadowed in this Lamb without blemish and without spot. And no person should be in any undue haste when considering the character and the nature of the Lamb of God. And after keeping it until the 14th day, and we come to verse 7. And then we find that it had to be killed in the evening. This leads us to one of the fundamentals of Scripture. A lamb in life cannot redeem. It is only when the blood was taken from the body and sprinkled that it had redemptive properties, evidence. Of course they resided there before death, but they only became worth in the story of redemption. And when some folks will tell you that there is efficacious and propitiatory value in the life of Christ, will you remind them of the story of the Passover? It wasn't because there was a lamb in the house that the Lord passed over the house. It was because death had taken place and the blood had been sprinkled and the house had been sanctified. And the destruction that took place elsewhere in Egypt never took place within a house in Israel where the blood had been applied. They had complete dispensation from them. The wrath and judgment that swept through the whole of Egypt, because the lamb was slain and because the blood was sprinkled. I've heard it said that we trade on a life we never lived. I want you to question that tonight, and question it in the light of the feast of Passover. The value of the life of Christ to us is made good only because of his Calvary death. The manner in which they had to eat the lamb would indicate to us that they were not allowed tremendous or great preparation. It had to be the simplest form of cooking and preparation. It would seem to me as if the Passover feast is now saying to us, the lamb on the altar was sufficient for the household, and the lamb on the table is sufficient for the food of the household. So the sufficiency of Christ is being brought to us again, without being encapsulated in anything except the fire in which it was roasted. In other words, you do not need to dress Calvary with anything other than what happened. And thus shall ye eat it in that night, roast with fire, and unleavened bread, and with bitter herbs they shall eat it. And this to them was the last meal in Egypt, for they were moving out. And the story of their redemption, which is then told from that verse right to the end of the chapter, is an outline to us of how God fulfilled his promise and how the predicted prophecy was all accomplished in a divine way. And if you had to read carefully through the balance of the chapter, you would find that the instructions given on that occasion could only be for the meal they were having in the land of Egypt. But because of the fundamental nature of it, this instituted feast in the land of Egypt had to become a memorial, an annual event, and all the years of pilgrimage, and right on through the centuries of time, God had entrusted the keeping of this feast to the nation. So when we turn to the book of Leviticus chapter 23, or to the book of Numbers chapter 29, we would find that further instructions are given on the celebration of the Feast of Passover. Those instructions have to do with its celebration in the wilderness, when for 38 years they wandered. And now you're saying to me, but what about the 16th of Deuteronomy? And if you had to turn to the 16th of Deuteronomy, you would find that Moses again is enjoining the nation to celebrate the Feast of Passover. But this time, he adds one or two different ideas. And what he's saying to them is, I am now giving instructions not only for the wilderness, but when you get into the land of Canaan, you will celebrate the Feast of Passover. And he gives instructions to guide them how they should do it when they get into the land. They would only do it in the place of his appointing. They had to come to the one place to celebrate the Feast of Passover. I know that three times in the year the males had to go up to Jerusalem. And they would surround Zion with singing. And they would, on those three occasions, celebrate feasts. But the first to be celebrated was the one of fundamental importance. It was the Feast of Passover. Little is said in the Old Testament of the celebration of Passover, except on some occasions when the nation of Israel was at one of those critical bends in their history, entering the land, Joshua 5, the recovery under Hezekiah, the great recovery under Josiah, the return by the faithful, as is recorded in Ezra. It must have also been held and celebrated in the times of Samuel, probably referred to by David in his 132nd Psalm. But from the obvious report of the history of Hezekiah and Josiah, reference is made to the time when Samuel celebrated the feast of Passover. Yet there is no record in that part of the history book of the Old Testament dealing specifically with Samson, with Samuel. But it is obvious that David and a few gathered with Samuel at Kirjath-Jearim in the field of the wood, and with the ark as the central gathering point, there they celebrated Passover. So much so for the primary meaning as to how it affected the nation of Israel. The same could be said of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The Feast of Unleavened Bread began on the evening of the Passover meal. And those feasts which began with a Sabbath found God working towards another Sabbath. The Feast of Unleavened Bread is a feast of a complete cycle. It ran for 7 days. It was intended to be a complete cycle. The nation that was redeemed, living in the good of that redemption, would now feel the not only the liberating and justifying power of the blood, but they would feel the inworking, sanctifying power of the blood. And they would feel that now their life was changed, and that truly that this month was a beginning of months, not only making them a nation, but making them a holy nation. Making them a nation now that would not go in with the pollutions and vices that they had practiced in Egypt. Now they would have an altar. Now they would have a priesthood. Now they would have sacrifices. Now they would serve the Lord. Didn't do that in Egypt. And the Feast of Unleavened Bread is the feast that sanctified to them the great work of redemption involved solidly within the Passover feast. And what arises out of the Feast of Unleavened Bread is the fact that God now was saying to them, "You're my special people. My love rests on you and my pleasure is in you." And because of that honor bestowed upon them, God desired that they would be a people like unleavened in life and in service. That they would never again touch what belonged to the world from which they had been freed. And that the old leaven that they once enjoyed would be gone and gone forever. And now they would enter into a new life altogether. A life that would go from one cycle into another cycle. And it was a feast of 7 days. Passover was a once feast, if you like. But unleavened bread was a continuous exercise. I think you've got the point. And this would lead me into the prophetic import. And that is why I turn to the New Testament, where Paul updates the feast of Passover and of unleavened bread for us in the 1st of Corinthians chapter 5. It's not the only epistle of Paul that deals with the truth of redemption. For example, in the great epistle of Romans, which is obviously being used, Exodus is obviously being used by Paul as he writes the epistle to the Romans. The first 11 chapters of Exodus is found within the first three chapters of Romans. And then from the middle of chapter 3 of Romans until you get to chapter 11, we are then entering into the good of the Passover and its consequences. We are then being taught the great truth of deliverance by blood, being justified by His blood, being justified by His grace. What does that mean? It simply means being freed, being delivered. When one thinks of the bondage that Israel once knew in Egypt and how they had been taken completely out of it and separated from it and never to return to it, all the bitterness of that bondage was gone and gone forever. And what separated them from it was the blood of the Passover lamb. As is Paul in Romans 3 and then in Romans 5. It's the blood of Christ. It's the death of propitiation. That has brought us justification. That has brought us justification unto life. And if we had to look at the prophetic input from the Galatian point of view, we would see that he there deals with the giving up of the life of the Lord Jesus in a voluntary way for our sins. Why? So that redemption could come to us, not only unto life, but unto liberty. And he tells us in Galatians that we are not only freed from the bondage that sin brings, but we are free from the law that makes sin revive and causes all the bother with us. And says Paul, the Passover sacrifice of Christ has freed us and brought us into life that's glorious and has given to us liberty that is real freedom indeed. When we turn to the epistle to the Corinthians, we find in chapter 5 that in the process of dealing with the purity of an assembly, in the process of showing that the assembly ought to be a meeting place of people who live in the good of unleavened bread, who do not practice what belongs to the old leaven of malice and wickedness, but who live in the light of the sun, that's the idea behind the word sincerity, who stand out to be transparent in the sight of God. They go in for the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. There is no wax or counterfeit about them. They are unleavened, says Paul. They are a new lump. In other words, Paul is saying, what was said of the unleavened bread feast of Israel is now true in Corinth. And he's now going to speak about how to deal with the awful sin that had come in, and the need for dealing with it, so that the assembly could show that it is the product of the Passover Christ sacrificed for us. And for that Passover of Calvary to be misrepresented in the impure living of a Christian who is a member of an assembly was a complete enigma to the Apostle Paul. Why, he says, the impeccable purity of Christ has now taken sin and brought it within grip. And now, even in the present age, sin does not need to have dominion over you. Why? Because Christ, your Passover, has been sacrificed for you. And he doesn't go into the argument of Romans 6 and Romans 7 to prove it, but he simply looks at the issues and consequences of the feast of Passover and unleavened bread and brings them right into the circumstances of the Corinthian church and shows them that they cannot condone or tolerate the sin of malice, of wickedness, moral or otherwise. But then we wanted to turn to 1 Peter. For it seems to me that the man who has the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, within the first exhortation that he gives, You will recall that we first of all read together about how we have to gird up the loins of our minds. And isn't that what he says in verse 13? And then you immediately think of that word that those pilgrims of Israel got, that they had to gird up their loins, that they had to have shoes on their feet and a staff in their hand. Why? Because something great had happened to them. They were being redeemed. One of the many involvements within that is simply this, that Jehovah was going to link his name with them as a nation. Oh, the grace involved in that. They were a motley crowd of slaves, but the great God of order as seen in creation, and the almighty and all-wise God is now coming down to deliver and to link his own name with them. And says Peter, we have been linked with him, and now we don't call him Jehovah, says Peter. What do we call him? Well, you look at verse 17 of 1 Peter 1, and you'll find Peter saying, and if you call him Father, and you think of the intimacy that's involved in this. This is not simply calling on him in prayer that's involved, but this is now appreciating I'm associated with him and with his name. Therefore, says Peter, become ye holy. In other words, go in for the feast of unleavened bread. Enjoy the great truth of gradual sanctification, of progressive sanctification. Become ye holy, for I am holy. And you say that your name is now linked with ours. And if you call him Father, why should you do it? For you have been redeemed. Not with corruptible things, such as silver and gold. Says Peter in verse 18, not with the silver and gold, and not from the vain way of life received by tradition from your fathers, but with the precious blood of Messiah. Not with a lamb that was selected from the herd, not the kid of a goat, as probably would take place in Exodus 12 in many of the family homes, but with the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb, without blemish and without spot. That is, says Peter, from the external there was no flaw. And when he was opened up at Calvary, there was no blemish. And when each part was laid out in that sacrifice, it was all absolutely perfect and impeccably holy, with the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb, without blemish and without spot, who wasn't kept from the 10th to the 14th day, but verily was foreordained before the foundation of the world, but evident in these last times for you. Well, says Peter, what should this do for us? What was the challenge to Israel? That their faith and hope would be in God, that they would accept the word that Moses and Aaron received, and firmly they would follow the mediator, their leader, and their faith and hope would be in God. Why should we doubt or despair? Our Passover has been sacrificed, says Peter. His name is linked with ours now, and he has brought us into the good of a life of holy living. And then he says that your faith and your hope might be in God. I would like to have said more about the practical implications of all this, but unfortunately our time has gone. It may well be that in the question time you may wish to explore that particular phase of the discussion.